Happy New Hampshire primary night. Welcome to the Dallas Lawsuits Forum. Can you hear me in the back? How's that sound? Does that sound okay? It's not cutting out. We had a problem with this
a couple weeks ago. Welcome to the Dallas Lawsuits Forum. We are a nonprofit organization. Our goal is to bring philosophy, ideas, critical thinking, intellectual discussion to the DFW area. We are an all-volunteer group. I do want to recognize we have a new board member, Skip Kilmer. If you want to raise your hand, Skip. We appreciate his help. He's our new secretary. He has spoken to our group before. Real talented addition to our board, and we are appreciative to Skip. I'm Rob Olson. I want to thank everyone for coming out. We meet on the second and fourth Tuesday of the month from September through May. We'll be first-time visitors. Anybody? Okay, just all, we all, a lot of veterans here. Back in the corner, is there any?
Sean.
No, Sean's been here. Yeah, Sean's been here three or four times.
Second time.
He's an old timer.
and I'm not sure.
He's the youngest person in the whole place.
As long as the lights are, you're good.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, no, the top five, bottom five, whatever.
This part of the
So, do so immediately after the lecture. David Drum, our treasurer, will take your money. And sometimes people might forget to pay. They get in late, so please make sure that you pay, as well as remind everyone to pay your meal or your drinks before you leave at the front of the restaurant. So anyway, before we move forward, I would like to recognize our Director Emeritus, Bob Berman. Bob, can you step up here for a minute? Bob was one of the early people to establish this organization back in the early 80s. And I was reading, Bob is a poster child for someone who is aging a bit, and who continues to learn, continues to educate himself. And I was reading about how people, when they get into their 60s, 70s, 80s, if they are constantly learning and engaging in intellectual discussion and ideas, that helps immunity with that type of with diseases, Alzheimer's and things like that. And this man, he's 88 years old. He is sharp as a tack. He's a director emeritus with the Dallas Lawsuits Forum, and I know I'm speaking for David and Jack and the rest of the board. We are very indebted to this gentleman.
Well, thank you very much.
We have a gift. We have a gift for you. You can open it up.
I'll just make it a rule that I changed my philosophy every 6 years. 6 years. So I'm in the midst of studying and looking at new ways of looking at things. So keep doing that yourselves. Don't ever get stuck down into one aspect or one attitude. Be open. The world is keeping changing. You keep changing too. That's my advice today.
Thank you, Bob. You're welcome. We're just thrilled to have you here. And Fred Grinnell, our speaker, Dr. Grinnell, was also one of the early founders of the Dallas Lawsuits Forum. And that was around 1980. You two gentlemen were active very, very early on in our organization.
It was one of our first speakers.
Right.
And Bob Winicky.
Bob Winicky, yes. Bob as well. Bob Winicky.
And Winicky, yes.
Yes. Give a hand for Bob as well. We've had a lot of talented men and women over the years in our group. Okay, so does everybody have our spring schedule, spring of 2016? If you want a copy, it's on our website, www.philosophersforum.org. And then it's on our website. And if you'd like a hard copy, I can bring one to you after the lecture tonight. You can also sign up for updates on the meetings through www.meetup, and we've gotten a lot of people through the meetup group. Tonight, our speaker will present for about 45 minutes, and then we'll open it up to questions. I'm often told that's one of the more enjoyable parts of the lecture is the Q&A. And so I just ask that you make a short statement and not turn into a soliloquy. And I know people here are very, very verbose and very good speakers. Topical, obviously. But try to get your question as soon as possible. And when I see, please turn off your cell phones or put them on vibrate mode at this time. I have to tell my students at UNT, I'm an adjunct there, I have to tell them to no texting, but I don't have to tell you folks no texting. So anyway, we're very privileged. It's a real treat to have Dr. Fred Grinnell from UT Southwestern Medical Center with us tonight. He often comes, oh, Jerry, we're not again.
Yeah.
He often comes to as an attendee, but he's spoken several times, and it's always just a great, great lecture. It's so informative, and he really knows his material. Fred Grinnell is an American cell biologist. Oh, I also wanted to welcome his wife, Gail Grinnell. We can get a round of applause for Gail. We're very pleased to have Gail with us as well. Fred Grinnell is an American cell biologist, also known for his work in bioethics. He is Robert McLemore, Professor of Medical Science in the Department of Cell Biology at UT Southwestern. He's been there since around 1972 or so, something like that. Dr. Grinnell earned his PhD in biochemistry at Tufts University in 1970. In bioethics, Grinnell engages in cross-disciplinary work at the boundary between science and philosophy. His goal is to inform public policy and to advance science education and public understanding of science. Dr. Grinnell has published two books, The Scientific Attitude, now in its second edition, and Everyday Practice of Science, Where Intuition and Passion Meet Objectivity and Logic, which was a finalist in the 2010 Royal Society Book Prize competition. Dr. Grinnell will be speaking tonight about the meaning of objectivity. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Fred Grinnell.
Thank you very much. Is this going to go on? Yes?
It was green.
Some of us are down here.
Well, you know, it's red now, so get to green.
Okay, this will, I don't know what's going on with that. Push it all the way over. You're good.
Good?
Yeah.
All right. So good? Can you hear?
Yes.
Good. So this has a little clip on it, and I already broke the clip off. So I'm hoping the lecture tonight goes better than the clip went. Well, I'm going to put it in this pocket. So, and this is, I have to find a place here to stand. Can I move this over?
Yeah, you can move it.
Yeah. Meaning of objectivity. So that's what I'm going to talk about tonight for about 45 minutes. Hopefully, I haven't given this talk before, so I'm thinking it'll be about 45 minutes, but you never know. That is Bob doesn't interrupt me. Actually, the two Bobs ran this organization for quite a while. They did a fantastic job of doing that. So this is a Scientific America has a blog about science, doing good science, and Janet Stenwedel, who's a philosopher, wrote a series of three pieces on the blog about the ideal of objectivity. I like Janet a lot. I know her. She's a friend. And I like the pieces, including because she referred to some of my work. You always like that when that happens. And she writes, objectivity is a value, perhaps one of the values that scientists and non-scientists most strongly associate with science. And then she goes on to say that objectivity, in her view, has two meanings that are distinct. I'm moving back over here to try to make it possible for the people who are over there to see what's here. What anyone applying the appropriate methodology could see and what the world is really like. And obviously the goal is that if you do one properly, you get to two, and that's sort of the way we typically think about objectivity. And I agree with that, but I want to think about objectivity in a broader context. It interests me, so I want to ask the question, is objectivity a value associated with the artistic and religious, as well as the scientific attitude? And if so, how does objectivity differ between these different attitudes. So we engage in a lot of different things in life. We have a lot of ways that we interact with the world, and we think usually about science as being objective, and a lot of times as some of these other activities as not being objective. So I want to explore if they are, and if they are, how that objectivity works, and how that relates to the objectivity of science. So thank you for mentioning the science, one of my books. This is The Scientific Attitude. And I started thinking about this question a long time ago when I started working in philosophy of science. And I was interested in the scientific attitude and how that attitude differed from other attitudes towards life experience. So here are three examples of different attitudes. All the spheres revolve around the sun as their midpoint, and therefore the sun is the center of the universe. That's Copernicus. But soft what light through yonder window breaks, it is the east, and Juliet is the sun. That's Shakespeare. And Joshua spoke to the Lord and said, in full view of Israel, sun stands still over Gibeon and moon in the valley of Ajalon. And that's the Bible. So those are three different ways of talking about the sun. And it's using the same word. And the question is, well, what sun is it? Is it the sun, is it always the same sun? Or are those different contexts? What do they mean? And how does one understand that relationship? And it's possible to really use words in different ways, but be part of the same kind of attitude. And so here are a couple of examples. Eskimos can observe 30 different kinds of snow and 10 different kinds of mud, but only have one word for flower. And South American cowboys have 200 different horse colors, but divide the plant world into fodder, bedding, woody materials, and all others. Well, I don't personally think that I would recognize more than, you know, maybe two kinds of snow, you know, wet and dry. But the point is that these designations by Eskimos of the different kinds of snow and cowboys about the different colors of horses, they more, to me, fit into this group up here of the scientific attitude. I think even though I don't know what those words mean exactly, I could learn about them in the same way that I would think about science. So there's something different about the scientific attitude versus the artistic attitude about the religious attitude. And this is a big deal when you're actually doing science. So because a lot of doing science has to do with seeing objects. And in my kind of science, the objects that we typically are looking at are cells. So what's a cell look like? I mean, we have a theoretical notion of what a cell looks like. But because I teach histology to medical students, I know that even though they have a very, very, very robust theoretical understanding of a cell, they can't recognize one in a microscope until I tell them which ones are which. And I know that because I had to learn how to do that. So here are some pictures of different kinds of tissues. And this big thing here, that's a neuronal cell. And this big thing here, that's an arterial. And you wouldn't know that unless I taught you that. And this thing over here, these long things, these are muscle cells. Who says muscle cells? Oh, that's a dermatologist in this crowd. Yeah, physician. You know, we got a ringer. Actually, another ringer over there. You were one of my students, right? Yes, you see, and his too. So Snell over here, he and I have been teaching together histology to medical students at Southwestern for a long time. So these medical students, you have to come in, and they have to learn how to see these. So what it tells you is that seeing something as an object is not just seeing what's there. It's also having learned how to see it as an object. And there's an expression that describes this way of thinking. It's my favorite one. It's called thought style. And it was an idea introduced by a man named Ludwig Fleck, who wrote this fabulous book called Genesis and Development of a Scientific Fact, which is about the story of the discovery of syphilis, which starts out as a religious disease in the 15th century and becomes an infectious disease in the 20th century. And he describes historically how that change occurred over that 500-year period. And basically what he says is that previous knowledge and experience, and that means our individual biographies and personalities, determine what we can notice and what we think it means when we notice those things. And this idea of thought style is not unique, actually, to Fleck. Jean Piaget talked about schemata as a child grows and learns to understand the world. A Brit named Michael Polanyi called this tacit knowledge. Many of us have heard of Thomas Kuhn, who talked about paradigms, and a much less well-known philosopher of physics called Gerald Holton called these schemata. But they all have the same basic idea, and that's this previous knowledge and experience. And just to make sure we all are on the same page, this is a what? It's a smiley face. Everybody agrees with that. We all share that thought style. Okay? This is a
bowling ball.
Yeah, but not everybody here sees it as a bowling ball, I bet. Because if you don't do bowling, or if you don't, you know, you might not see this as a bowling ball. And this is a nobody has any clue. So the point is that we all of us share elements of our thought style and have some that are disparate. And another thing is that
when I get drunk.
Okay. that comes to this one. Seeing things one way means not seeing them another. And you notice, interestingly, that this little hole in the center changes according to the surrounding circumstances. These are what are called gestalts. And this one is a nose, and this one is a thumb hole, and this one is whatever you want it to be. But its meaning is not the same. So you see it in one way, you see it in another, and it depends on its context. So what Fleck said, and which I believe, is that all discovery, and he's talking about discovery in science, is learning how to see or think in new ways to supplement, develop, and transform the thought style.
Exactly.
And here's the kind of thing that I think I try to diagram. So you notice something when you're doing science, and you have to, if you notice something, you don't know what it is. The question is, well, what is this? You got to try to figure out what it is, and you have to guess what it might be. And when you guess and you try to do some experiments to see if you're right, and you begin to see, maybe I'm beginning to get close because it looks, I'm beginning to see something here that looks a little bit better than this, and you continue to do this until finally you figure out what it is. And at the beginning, it doesn't look anything like this, except it sort of looks like this. So if you can notice something, a lot of times you can do experiments, or you can try to investigate them. And here's a practical example. This is an experiment that I did in 1975 when I was studying how cells, these are cells, another view of cells, how cells interact with their extracellular environment. And I wanted to know how they attached it. And I noticed what I thought between these two was that these cells all change shape, as opposed to these, didn't change shape. And, you know, some people might agree or not agree, but this is a pretty ugly picture, and there's a lot of dirt, and I didn't really, but once I saw this, then I could try to figure out, you know, what was going on there, and 6 months later, I could do this, where now it was real easy to see this change. So that's sort of what happens. You learn to observe objects in new ways as science is going on. So that's part of this process of discovery in science. Well, William James, who's one of my favorite philosophers, talked about how we encounter the world and see objects. And he talked about the stream of thought. And he says, the mind is at every stage a theater of possibilities. It works on the data it receives like a sculptor working on a block of stone. And in this sense, the statue stood there from eternity, but there were 1,000 different ones possible. And we have to thank the sculptor for giving us the one that the sculpture gives us. So the sculptor alone is to thank for having extricated this one from all the rest. So the sculptor and the sculpture make up a kind of interacting unit. So that would be just fine And you could think of research as scientists engaged in trying to expose new objects or ideas in the block of reality with which they're working. So, Michelangelo commented on this also. And here's what he said. He said, in every block of marble, I see a statue as plain as though it stood there before me. I have only to hew away the rough walls that imprison the lovely apparition. If that's all he had said, then I could have ended this lecture right now. But he said something else. He continued the sentence. What he said was to reveal it to other eyes as mine see it. So that is the claim of objectivity. He's saying that the statue once revealed has an independent identity. It has objective content that permits others to see the lovely apparition as he sees it. But how can Michelangelo be sure he's right? This is the book plate of the UK Royal Society, United Kingdom Royal Society. It's the oldest scientific establishment in the world. Started in 1660. If you read down here, it says Nullius in Verba. Do we have any Latin scholars? Don't take anybody's word for it. That's what it means. Or as somebody else said, in God we trust. All others must bring data. Okay? So we can't depend. Michelangelo might say it's there, but you know what? He might be wrong because we have the problem of subjectivity. And what subjectivity is it's illustrated so well by this famous painting by René Magritte called The False Mirror. And it's making fun of the idea that when we look out at the world, what we see is simply a reflection of what's there. But what really one sees is a reflection of the outside world, the objective reality, and the inside world, our individual subjectivity. So all knowledge is interpretation. So we have to get beyond that. How do we do it? How do we seek objectivity? We show other people.
Yeah, agreement.
That's how we get to see other people. That's what Janet Stemwall was talking about at the beginning. We transcend our subjectivity through intersubjectivity, which is an idea known as reciprocity of perspectives, which basically says that if somebody was standing here and looking out at this, they would more or less see the same thing I do, because we share the world and we share our ability. It's like getting back to those diagrams I showed you of the smiley face, etc. So, and just as an aside, the only way you can do this is by making public what you believe to be the case. Because if you don't do that, then nobody else can check out what you just said. So if Michelangelo didn't say that he believed it was like it was, nobody would have known that. So another one of my favorite philosophers is a man named Alfred Schütz. And he wrote about and argued, and I agree, I learned from him, the idea that reciprocity of perspectives is the intersubjective feature of life that makes possible all social interactions. If we didn't share a language, if we didn't share perceptions of the world, we would be unable to communicate and interact with each other. It's our shared perception which is the grounds for our interactions with each other. So there's a kind of hidden objectivity in all of those interactions. And what Schütz says is that objective meaning sort of is abstracted through those interactions between ourselves, okay, and it becomes anonymous. It's no longer anybody's in particular. It becomes impersonal and detached. It becomes knowledge that's the same for everyone, for me, for you, for everyone. That's interesting, and it depends on the repeatability and the continuity of experience. And I'll get back to that, except that just to make sure it's clear what I mean, I was fortunate enough to study with one of Schütz's students, who, when I studied with him, actually was a pretty old guy, named Maurice Natanson, And he used to do these mind experiments about, you know, what it would be like. So here's a mind experiment, a dialogue of what happens when repeatability and continuity of experience fail. And to set this up, there's a coffee shop. There's a guy who serves coffee and a guy who's been coming in to get coffee for the last 10 years. And it happens every day until Jones says, "Hello, good to see you again, the usual." Smith says, "Usual what?" Jones says, "Non-fat cafe mocha espresso with no whipped cream." Smith says, "You're not making sense." Jones says, "Well then, what can I do for you today?" Smith, "That's a long story, one day. I haven't time for it." Jones, "Something wrong?" Smith, "Don't jump to conclusions. You might not make it. Too much distance to cover." Jones, "If you'll excuse me, it's getting frustrated now. Sir, I have some other things to do. Perhaps I can serve you another time." Smith, "What other time? It will still be now. Now is when I want service." So Nathan says, teaches us with this kind of dialogue that if you don't have repeatability and continuity, it totally destroys the possibility of interactions between individuals. Okay. Well, now, unlike Michelangelo, not all artists make intersubjectively testable claims about the objectivity of their work. Jackson Pollock says, "Painting is a state of being, self-discovery. Every good artist paints what he is." That's kind of hard to, you know. And Franz Klein says, "The final test of painting, theirs, mine, any other, is, does the painter's emotion come across?" Well, it's, you know, it's kind of, it's not an object. It's not exactly like a Michelangelo claim, and art sometimes explicitly rejects scientific objectivity. So this is an Emily Dickinson poem. "A color stands abroad on solitary hills that science cannot overtake, but human nature feels." So there's a color. Nature can feel it, science cannot. And here's one of my favorite poems that expresses the idea, Walt Whitman's famous poem, "When I Heard the Learned Astronomer." "So when the proofs, the figures were ranged in columns before me, when I was shown the charts and diagrams to add, divide, and measure them, when I sitting heard the astronomer where he lectured with much applause in the lecture room, how soon, unaccountable, I became tired and sick, till rising and gliding out, I wandered off by myself in the mystical, moist night air. And from time to time, looked up in perfect silence at the stars." So that's a whole different way of experiencing the world. There's not the same kind of objectivity there that Michelangelo is claiming. So I like to think about these two ways of the way two philosophers, or even a single philosopher on two different days, might be walking along a beach and encounter a rock. Another philosopher once says to himself, "How did this rock get here? And what kind of rock is it anyway?" And that information is very useful to have if you want more rocks, or if you want to use the rocks for something, or if you want to get less rocks, or you want to send the rocks somewhere else. That's the scientific attitude. The other one might say, "What does it mean for my life that this rock and I share this beach together at this moment?" That's also a legitimate question. It's a good question. This doesn't have the same kind of thing as the scientific attitude, but it reminds you of Emily Dickinson or Walt Whitman. It's a kind of existential relationship about what life is and what it is. So Aaron Gerwich, who's another one of these philosophers in that Schutz group, they're called phenomenologists, wanted to think about, well, when we experience something, what is that experience like? What's it made of? So Gerwich says, well, there actually are three components to every experience. There's the figure, the background, and the horizon. So just to think about the figure and the background, which he says are always interchangeable, just think about this figure here, which you can look at, and depending upon how you sort of look at it, and whether you squint, You change your mind, you can see it as two faces looking at each other, or as a vase in between the two faces. Can everybody see those two different things? So it's a visual.
Oh, yeah. Optical illusion.
So he says, what you see here depends on which is the figure, and depending upon how you see the relationship, the figure and background can switch places. So what's the horizon? Horizon is always me here now. It's always mine. I'm the one who's seeing that right now, or actually I'm not. I mean, you are. We all are. But, me here now is sort of the index, usual index of having that experience. And other stuff, that under other stuff is where these different attitudes are sitting. So what's the other stuff for the scientific attitude? Those are the assumptions of the scientific attitude. And there are two of them, it seems to me. One is Hume, the British philosopher Hume, pointed out, discussed in his famous inquiry concerning human understanding. He was talking about the sun and whether it would come up and why we expect it to come up the next day and the next day and the next day. He said, what assurance do we have beyond immediate sense, experience, and memories for existence or matters of fact? The belief that the course of nature will continue uniformly the same we take for granted without any proof. That's one of our assumptions, enabling us to do science. It's that continuity and repeatability that I was actually talking about before. And then the other, this is a typical example of the expression, but one I like because it was Einstein's. Einstein says we have faith. Faith in the possibility that the regulations valid for the world of existence are rational, that is comprehensible to reason. So that's it. In science, it's me here now. Things are going to stay the same so I can study them and I can understand the way things are. And those are all the assumptions of science. So the path to scientific credibility starts out with the individual's me here now, Professor someone in particular. And it goes through this sort of radically intersubjective change over time, what another philosopher called, Annette Baer called the commons of the mind. We reason together, challenge, revise, and complete each other's reasoning and each other's conceptions of reason. So that's how we do this, and we end up with the scientific community's intersubjective, anywhere, anyone, anytime. Professor someone in particular, Professor, it could be anyone. The information becomes abstracted and anonymous. It's no longer anybody's in particular. And William James, back to James, says, credibility happens to knowledge claims. They become credible or made credible by events. So you don't know at the beginning what's right and what's wrong. It's over time that things become, through validation and verification, what's right or what's wrong. We settle for truth with a small t. Science always settles for truth with a small t in the present. The absolutely credible truth with a capital T is always sometime in the future. And in this case, it's clear that objectivity depends on the community. So it's an achievement of scientific inquiry, not its starting point. A lot of people think that. And I like what James writes. We have to live today by what truth we can get today and be ready tomorrow to call it falsehood. Ptolemaic astronomy, Euclidean space, Aristotelian logic, scholastic metaphysics were expedient for centuries. But human experience has boiled over those limits and we now call those things only relatively true or true within those borders of experience. Absolutely, they are false. And if James was alive today, he would add Newtonian mechanics being replaced by quantum mechanics, and Darwin's evolutionary tree of life being replaced by the web of life. Not that evolution is wrong, but it's just more complex in some ways than he could have imagined. So it's good in this context to think about science in terms of the three types of baseball empires. You know these three types of empires. I call them as they are. I call them as I see them. What I call them is what they become. Okay? This This is the umpire that claims truth. And 100 years ago, an awful lot of people thought this was the way science works. This is the umpire that claims power. And in the postmodern thinking and the claim that science is all power and that it's all language games. Context. That's what we've been talking about here. So objectivity in science is neither truth nor power, but it's balanced on this contextual ledge in between. And the success of this way of thinking about the world, we gain from thinking about how we've controlled populating the world and how our technologies have come and replaced each other and had the kind of impact that they've had in changing the world around us. This is what Benjamin Franklin said about this, our first scientist. When agriculture is improved, trade enlarged, the arts of living made more easy and comfortable, and of course the happiness of mankind promoted, knowledge then really becomes useful. So it's usefulness. Okay. So how about some other attitudes? This is the one that's exactly the opposite to science. The mystical attitude. No one, nowhere, out of time. So when I was in college, Zen Buddhism was very popular. We all read Zen Buddhism by Suzuki. We learned about enlightenment called Satori. Satori was a kind of scary idea because if you had it, it said that everything was going to change in your ability to understand the world. Satori was looking into the nature of things in contradistinction to analytical or logical understanding. The unfolding of a new world, hitherto unperceived, in the confusion of a dualistically trained mind. We see things as black and white. All the opposites and contradictions are united and harmonized. And the methodology of Zen Buddhism was what's called the koan. And this was always a statement or a set of statements which were internally contradictory. And the Zen master or student to become a master would reflect on these contradictory statements until they gained an understanding somehow, we don't really know, but of that, and I'm going to explain to you of what it was. So here's an example. The wind was flapping a temple flag. Two monks were arguing about it. One said the flag was moving. The other said the wind was moving. Arguing back and forth, they could come to no agreement. The sixth patriarch said, "It is neither the wind nor the flag. It is your mind that is moving." And then the commentator said, "They're all wrong. They all missed it. Although he knows how to open his mouth, he does not see that he was caught by words." As soon as you begin talking about something, as soon as you create boundaries, some aspect of the truth of what you're encountering is gone. If you think of truth about just what you're encountering. And my favorite description of this is in Buber, Martin Buber, the famous Jewish rabbi, his book, I and Thou. He says, "The form that confronts me I cannot experience nor describe, and yet I see it far more clearly than all the clarity of the experienced world, not as a thing, but as what is present. Tested for its objectivity, it's not there at all. But what can equal its presence? And it is a actual relation, it acts on me, and I act on it. What then does one experience of the Thou? Nothing at all, for one does not experience it. What then does one know of the Tao? Only everything, for one no longer knows particulars." So this is a remarkable way of thinking. What happens is this. It just disappears. Reflecting. Goes away. Everything's gone. And now you know everything somehow. And these experiences, which are indescribable in words, ineffable, can be for the individual revelatory and authoritative in meaning, which is noetic. These are the technical terms. So these are teaching the truths of the unseen order. Now, why do I call this the unseen order? So this is where this idea, and that's because of William James' definition of what religion is. William James says religion is, in the most general terms, belief that there's an unseen order, and that the best good is in harmoniously adjusting oneself thereto. Those are the only two things that he describes as religion: belief in an unseen order, and that the belief in that the good life is adjusting oneself to that order. So that definition allows for one God, or many gods, or no God. Now, religion didn't necessarily start that way. Actually, in some of the earliest descriptions, religion started as experimental science. And this picture of Domenico Fetis, the triumph of Elijah or the prophets of Baal, is an example of that. This is from Kings. Ahab called the children of Israel, and he says, it's getting tired of this debate over who's the king, who's God. So Elijah says, okay, listen, you guys got 400 priests, I got myself, we're going to build two pyres, we're going to put a cow on each one, and whichever one burns, he's the real God. That's the real God. It's an empirical test. And they do it, and Elijah's, goes on fire, and Elijah says, okay, I'm the God. And in true religious form, the people then kill all the priests of Baal. But that's a different story. So, but the point is that they were talking about science in an experimental way. So if you go back to this idea of the background, the figure, and the horizon, the religious attitude becomes me here and now going to us. That us is the group of people who share the truth, a particular truth of the unseen order, anywhere, anytime. And one way that I see this all the time is when bioethics. So here's a book called The Human Rights, Ethical and Moral Dimensions of Healthcare. It's 120 case studies. And each of these case studies is discussed from the point of view of Catholic, Protestant, Jewish, Muslim, Buddhist, and agnostic sensitivities. And they're all different answers. Each one takes for granted a different unseen order. And using that unseen order as its basis, it then asks, what's the appropriate way to deal with a bioethics situation, given that order? So we can come up with lots of different answers. So acceptance of a particular set of assumptions is a characteristic of an individual's membership in a group. But then once you're in that group, intersubjective verification and objectivity become just as important as they do in science. It's just that there's a set of constraints underlying the conversation. But the conversation is just as robust. And another example of thinking about that is in this book, Halakhic Man, by Rabbi Soloveitchik, where he talks about a religious thinking as a kind of a priori mathematical system, where you start out with a bunch of assumptions, and then you ask, what flows from those assumptions? And he points out that the world was experienced as fully Euclidean at the time the non-Euclidean geometry was totally worked out. So you don't have to have, you can work out a whole system based upon something that is a set of starting assumptions. Much different from science. So what distinguishes objectivity in religion from objectivity in science is not the absence of intersubjective verification, but rather differences in the starting assumptions and goals. So science begins with the assumption of the possibility of understanding the way things are. I think we should call this intelligible design, just to be controversial. And objectivity and intersubject verification produce credible knowledge about how things are. Religion begins with assumption of core beliefs or truths, the unseen order, about how things are, and then objectivity and intersubject verification produce credible knowledge about how to harmoniously adjust oneself to that unseen order. So they're very parallel and involve very robust thinking. They just have slightly different starting assumptions. So the question is how to think about the relationship, for instance, in that case. And personally, for me, I think about it because of this, what went on at this conference. This was the 1927, the Fifth Solvay Conference. These are everybody here who's got a red date under his name. That was the year he won the Nobel Prize. All keys except for Madame Curie. She got it in 1911. And so there are all these pictures of all these incredible people. Here's Einstein. Here's Niels Bohr, right here. So here's what was going on. Einstein says in 1924, we now have two theories of light, particle and wave, both indispensable, but it must be admitted without any logical connection between them, despite 20 years of colossal effort by theoretical physicists. And Bohr then in 1927 at this meeting says, here's the answer. At the quantum level, no distinction can be made between the object and the experimental circumstances that permit the object to be observed. And he called this complementarity. And here's what the experiment was that led to this. So this is called the double slit experiment. So if you shoot a wave through two slits like this, this is the pattern that you get. If you shoot particles through two slits like this, this is the pattern you get. So when electrons were discovered, and there were now electron guns that could shoot electrons, you got a wave. So it looked like the wave, that the electrons were actually waves, not particles. But if you put a detector to see which holes they were going through, the wave pattern disappeared. And now it looks like particles. That's the spooky quantum world. And that's the way it is. So this is like getting back to the beginning of the talk. Observer and object make up an irreducible unit. And Bohr says, well, two different observations exhibiting complementarity cannot be selected or harmonized. They're mutually exclusive. Both are required for holistic understanding. And this was his shield that he adopted when he was knighted, which you'll recognize as the yin-yang. And this combination of talk and this shield led an awful lot of people to say, Bohr is promoting Eastern mysticism in place of physics. There was a lot of criticism. And it turned out that when Bohr was interviewed by Thomas Kuhn and Ajay Peterson in November 1962, he said, I read actually the work of William James. William James is really wonderful in the way he makes it clear. I think I read the book or a paragraph called, what is it called? It's called The Stream of Thought. Remember, that's the thousand different one statues beside it. The sculpture alone has had to thank us for the rest. So Bohr, we can think of science as scientific and other attitudes as interpretive tools, as instruments working on a block of reality, giving us different types of objective knowledge that exhibit complementarity required together for complete understanding. Bohr was very interested in promoting multicultural ways of understanding the world. But you have to be careful when you have that conversation that you don't mistake multiculturalism for cultural relativism. Just because something is right within a certain culture doesn't mean it's right. It just means that culture accepts it. All right, so the conclusions. Objectivity depends on and is made possible by intersubjectivity. Objectivity is a value required by the scientific attitude, but one that also can be an important part of the artistic and religious attitudes. Mm-hmm. That different attitudes, artistic, scientific, religious, go to different ways of practicing the world and create different domains of knowledge and action. And taken together, these different domains offer a holistic framework, complementarity, for how to understand and live in the world. And a lot of these ideas actually are described in more detail in Everyday Practical Science. So, I think it's available in local libraries if anybody's interested. they can read more about it.
Amazon? Is it on Amazon?
Oh, yeah, it's on Amazon. Anyway, so now we have discussion. Thank you very much.
Are there any questions? Oh, don't be shy now. You are not a shy group. Come on. Oh, no, I can't believe this. Well, Brian, about you say.
Well, I guess I have to rise to the occasion.
You always do.
It seems to me that the religious point of view, based on the axioms as you described it, that then makes a coherent set of arguments or practices, is, it has evolved for a different purpose than that of science. It evolved for the purpose of persuading people to behave in a pro-social way, that to cooperate and to be compassionate and be caring for others in the community, and also to unite the community against outside threats. So would you say that sort of justification is consistent with your point of view there, that the different domains offer a holistic framework?
Yeah, I think that your description, I don't know if everybody heard. Could everybody hear the comment? So that the idea is that that the origins of religion play a socializing role, both in a cohesive role for the group and how to live in the world. And I think that's exactly the point. You remember the philosophers meeting the rock, and the second one, I think that religion plays a very important role for people in understanding how to live in the world. But then they have the starting point of this particular unseen order, which for each group is relatively cohesive, creates a cohesive group, although in this day and age, with people spread out all over the world, these groups no longer are geographically located. Now they're everywhere, and that creates all sorts of interesting sociological dynamics that never existed before. But I would agree entirely with what you said.
I was interested in this concept of unseen realities. There's other senses too, unfelt, unheard, unsmelled, untasted. And if you can't experience a reality, to me it doesn't exist. Because how do I know it exists? Otherwise, I'm just making up fairy tales. And 90% of that kind of thinking are fairy tales. Once in a while, they fall into the truth by luck, and they find examples of in a scientific study that backs it up. But otherwise, it's just fantasy, and I can't see any reality or any validity to such type of thinking. That's just religion, and religion has nothing to do with science. I mean, it's two different worlds. If you want to be in the religious world, that's your business, but that's not reality. That's just your own subjective feelings. And we're talking about objectivity here. And it takes a subject and an object to have any knowledge. We are the subjects, and we have to experience it. And we do have to agree that we are experiencing the same thing, so we compare things with each other. And that's what makes them what we call a truth with a little t. As you said, there's no big T truth that we can know. So in the end, what I'm saying is, it takes subjectivity, objectivity, and a world, what Mary Paul T called, that's what makes a world and makes any knowledge that we have of it. And it takes all three. I always think of it as a stool, a three-legged stool of reality.
So I think that what Bob's saying, everybody I think probably got heard of it, is absolutely correct. and so here's why it's so important to understand that the sort of the objective turn that I was offering, and that is that I don't understand sort of mystical knowledge at all. I suspect that all of the different religious groups began with those kinds of mystical experiences. That's what James suggests. So you could have Moses and Jesus and and Buddha and all of them, getting some set of knowledge which then they they present as being the truth. So that aspect of it, we can't share. But to the extent that, let's say, Bob and I share a belief in one of those sets of unseen ways of understanding, we then can have a very objective discourse about how the best way to live in the world is, given that we believe that. So that, for instance, if we believe that it's wrong to take a human life, we can then create a whole philosophy of biomedicine sort of based upon, to some extent, that with that as the starting point. But the point, the thing that often concerns me is that when somebody says they're dealing with religion or art or something else, a lot of people think there's no objectivity there. And what they don't realize is that what's there is very objective once you get beyond the set of framework for the starting assumptions that people are making to have that discourse. So that's why you could have, for instance, the Catholic councils over hundreds of years debating with great logic, you know, what the implications are of a certain belief, or the Talmud and other Jewish documents. I think there was a question here and a question there.
So a little different thing here, but what I'm wondering is what you have any thoughts about kind of in the world today that people develop their beliefs over time, and these kind of get sort of hardwired. And then with the forms of media access that we have today, it's possible for individuals to continuously consume information or input that confirms what they believe over and over again. And so do you have any thoughts about the implications of that?
Well, what you're talking about is what I, the reason I made that comment about you have to be careful not to equate multiculturalism with cultural relativism. And that is that just because a group of people believe something and lots of information comes in from the outside to reinforce their beliefs, means that, it seems to me, that a good starting point is to worthwhile to think about and understand what they're thinking about and where it's coming from, but that doesn't mean you have to accept it. I mean, there are lots of behaviors that we just don't accept in other cultures or even in our own culture, and we can see those kinds of contradictions and conflicts within our own culture if you pick in a topic like, let's say, abortion. And the thinking about abortion it is formulated within a particular framework of thinking, and it's not shared by the folks who are either pro-life or pro-choice at all. And they just can't. They're just talking about different pages. But the arguments they're making, given their starting assumptions, are reasonable. It's just they're. We don't agree on the starting assumptions. And so, you know, I think that it becomes easy to get feedback, you know, for your particular set of beliefs, and it's hard often for people to get out of them because we're stuck, that's our thought stuff.
One of your fellow colleagues in the world of biology, Bruce Lipton, shared the stage with a gentleman named Rupert Sheldrake a lot, and came up with a term called the morphogenic field. And I was wanting to know what you felt like, how that would impact this.
So the morphogenic, it's not even morphogenic. So the morphogenic field, if I recall correctly, the morphogenic field was about the whole structure in a way that I'm not sure that, I think it was like vitalism, maybe was
collective consciousness, more or less.
So I don't know enough about it to say anything sensible. So I better say nothing at all.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it was like telepathy, actually, that somebody got an idea, or maybe a bird got an idea about how to open a milk bottle with a paper top, and it communicated that by some sort of telepathic method to all the other birds, and that's how they learned it so quickly. That was one of his founding.
Well, I have to say that the American Defense Department and probably DARPA, has been studying telepathy and all sorts of other things related to that, just on the outside chance that there might be something there, because if there is, they want it first.
Right? Didn't work because they were trying to detect it.
I was thinking that today it seems like, well, first, complementarity. That seems to be the attempt to try to understand other cultures. You don't necessarily have to believe them or accept them, but at least understand their point of view and to be empathetic towards what's going on in the world. But it seems like today what we see mostly are people trying to reach for power and bifurcate people and identify boundaries so they can gain additional power through these ideologies and establish their own objective. How do you feel about, how does that fit in
you are,
ethics and what's going on?
You are so exactly right. You know, your description, I think, is exactly what does happen. And one of the things about Boris, he wrote a lot about how important it was to do what you said, which is to understand other cultures. And he was writing especially a lot of this stuff in the 1950s when he was sure that we were going to have a nuclear war. And that if we didn't spend more time trying to understand each other, that would be the only way to prevent that. So,
how does a reach for power, fit in with the how does the reach for power fit into ethics, what you teach? I mean, it seems like what we're doing a lot today is reaching for power and bifurcating things. That doesn't seem to be ethical according to what you're also saying.
Well, I think that a lot of people do that, but at least in bioethics, there's tremendous sensitivity to the individual and their autonomy. And the importance of them choosing their own trajectory and not having it imposed upon them by someone else. And actually, it ends up sometimes, though, leading to certain kinds of conflicts when you have a culture where the family is sort of the decision-making group, not the individual. And in American medicine, the individual is the only decision-making group, the only decision-maker, not the family. So you want to inform the individual. Sometimes the family doesn't want them informed. But in general, I think that in bioethics, the idea of power, the sort of the parental approach to medicine, is something that to a large extent has been discarded. But there are power differences that we have to work at to make better. So when a physician and a patient are interacting with each other, there's an incredible power difference there. And it's interesting to hear physicians who write about their experience is as patients, because then you recognize that. So obviously power becomes very important. And in the United States, we have this very robust approach to dealing with issues relating to power. But there are a lot of countries in the world where that's not the case. And so we see dramatic differences between gender rights and other kinds of things. So, question here.
I was trying to think about differences between religion and science. And it seems that with science, there's the idea that there's a truth with a small t there, and there's an accepted process to understand the small truth that is there in the world. So to understand the world, scientists use intersubjectivity and all that to get it. But with religion, it seems the starting point is the truth with a capital T. And then the objectivity comes, I guess, in making sure that everyone in that particular religion feels the same way. So there's that intersubjectivity, but you start with the truth. You're not trying to seek what the truth is. And then I guess maybe one of the goals of religion is to get people to behave better. So you want to understand, scientists want to understand what's there, and religion wants to understand what do I do, it seems to me. And I guess some of the differences are between whether truth is taken from the beginning or whether you're trying to search for it. And I guess what you're saying is both systems can use objectivity to get there, but somehow there still seems to me to feel like there's a difference.
So there is a big difference between, because in the case of religion, you begin with certain truths. I don't think the intersubjectivity is involved in convincing other people that they're engaged in the same truth. That membership, that believing that is the condition for being a member. Once you become a member and you share that unseen truth that you get from however you get it, from your family or yourself or whatever it is, once you share that, then you can ask the question, given that truth, what's the best way to live in the world? And that's where the objectivity comes to play, it seems to me.
I enjoyed your talk this evening very much. One little phrase up on the screen there, different ways of practicing the world, struck me. We talked of practicing our religion, doctors practice medicine. My study is in religious studies, theology, and a lot of the direction I see it moving in is having to do with the practice, praxis, the old Greek concept of it isn't theory and then practice, it's the two work together. They're like the horizon and the object.
Right.
Yeah. It, you know, they can switch. The self, or whatever it is, that can switch depending on. You learn from your practice, and that helps develop the theory, and so on and so forth. But, I see this working in the religious world, in the Roman Catholic Church, with the practice of married couples and birth control is changing the theory about the meaning of marriage and so on. That's one of the things that's going on. And the other is the practice of, or the non-practice these days, of going to church. I come from a family, a good Catholic family of 10 children. I was a priest for a number of years, and I have a sister who's a nun. She's the only one that I'm certain goes to church every Sunday. One of my sisters maybe does. The rest of us, whenever. The practice is different. Our understanding in our, it's our truths are the small t's these days. And that's, I think, where more and more theologians are looking at religion that way. It doesn't start any longer with the capital T. It starts with areas of concern that we live, and then we learn from that.
So what you're saying I think everybody should recognize that the Catholic Church, its social structure and policies and ways of thinking about things have changed incredibly over the last 500 years. Incredibly. In all sorts of things relating to social interactions and family and everything else. See, that's where I see the change occurring through intersubjectivity. I see that as the objectivity of the church reacting to its assumptions, the unseen assumptions, changing its intersubjectivity understanding of how to live in the world, given those assumptions, as the world changes around us. So I don't see the truth of the church changing. Those things were all small t's, but they were the practices that were established in order to figure out how to live in the world, given those starting assumptions, which are different from other starting assumptions of some other religion. So that's exactly an example. And this is my favorite expression, because it's mine, talk about practicing the world. And I think a lot of people think it's sort of, you know, weird. My goal has been to understand science by understanding how it's practiced. Because there's a lot of theory of science. And theory of science and practice of science are completely different. So since I talk about practicing science, I then started talking about practicing art and practicing religion, and that led me to this idea of talking about how we practice the world. So actually, the sixth chapter of Everyday Practice is called Faith, More Than One Way of Practicing the World. And one type of faith for science is that you can understand the world and that it's going to stay the same over time. And the other way of faith is this, you know, you start out with an assumption of certain truths, and then you figure out how to live in the world given those truths. So
okay, we have time for two more questions. So one more question after I'll take the question.
Fred, I'd like to ask a question from a different point of view aspect. I gave a talk about how beliefs are hardwired into the brain, that you know, because the brain wants to make sense of the world that we live in, and those beliefs may be non-scientific, spiritual, you know, the unseen world, and it may be molecules, atoms, and force fields. Science has beliefs too. And it seems to me that when those, you know, and as long as the belief systems, you know, work, everything's fine. You know, but then when something comes up like, well, maybe Newtonian physics isn't the answer. Maybe Galileo, and Copernicus are right. Or whenever a belief system becomes challenged, there's such an inertia, a resistance to that objective change, that's where the conflict comes. So even though there was an objective truth out there somewhere with a big T, we get used to living with the small T, and that when it's challenged by a new discovery, new paradigm, that's when the conflict arises.
Yeah, so that's the notion of thought style that's so important that everybody can understand, and that is that we have learned through our personality, through our experiences, to have a certain way of understanding the world. And then it's very hard to notice. A lot of times when somebody does an experiment, they only notice what they expect. And all sorts of cool things might have happened, but they just missed them. Because we are expecting things to be in a certain way. The phenomenologists call this the natural attitude. And in human research, for instance, it's extraordinarily difficult to get somebody who's a potential subject of research to understand this is not therapy. It's research. The chances of it's helping you are very slim. Okay? You're doing this for the rest of the world. But the person who says, I want to do it, is really thinking, this is therapy for me. It's going to get me better. So that the natural attitude is the way we live in the world. And it's only when something happens that makes us stop and say, hey, what's going on here? So like if you go to that door and you go to leave and you push on the door and it doesn't open. And you push on the other door and say, hey, what's going on here? And all of a sudden, you're out of your natural attitude now and you're trying to explore the assumptions that you had about the way things work. And so, it can lead to conflict and all sorts of things. I don't believe it's hardwired, but I do believe it has that same impact. There was one more question.
Last question.
Yeah, I'm curious what the purpose of drawing this distinction is between objective and subjective. After all, intersubjectivity is still subjectivity, right? In a given culture, a given time frame. And whereas one could, I guess, take the pragmatist approach, does it work? So is there some kind of linguistic issue here? I mean, what's the purpose of drawing this distinction?
There are a couple of aspects to that. Let's just leave aside the pragmatist aspect, which, you know, you can ask if something. So a lot of people didn't like William James. William James's conclusion that religion is true because it has a positive impact on the people who believe it. So he said that, you know, from a pragmatist point of view, the truth of religion is its effect on the believers. And it doesn't matter if somebody else says it doesn't make any sense. So that the importance of I make the distinction between objective and subjective is to try to understand where knowledge comes from and how we gain knowledge, and to avoid discounting knowledge that's not gained by the way that typically we think about the world as being scientific. So there are a lot of people who think that if it's not science, it doesn't mean anything. And I don't personally agree with that. I think that there's lots of value in understanding other ways of understanding the world, even if they are not ways that have that, it's sort of like the Emily Dickinson poem or the Walt Whitman poem. I can relate to that. I don't know exactly why, but it means something to me. But it's clearly not the same thing as science, and so I've spent a lot of time trying to understand that distinction. I'm not sure that I do yet, but it has been and continues to be a fun adventure to do that. So.
Okay, so round of applause. We asked Dr. Grinnell.
Oops, sorry.
We're making a donation, $25 donation to a charity of his choice, and we asked him about that, and he selected the American Kidney Fund. So we can send that. We can send that ourselves under your name, or you can send it however you'd like.
You'll send.
Okay.
Her sister-in-law is on their board of directors.
She's very
involved in that charity.
And we have a gift for you as well. Same thing we got for Dr. Berman. Would you like coffee? Yeah. Coffee? Yeah. Nell's lost her form bug.
Fantastic.
So whenever you drink your coffee, you think about what a wonderful group we are, right?
That's right.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.